with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And with me today is the ever very capable Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, who will handle the majority of the presentation. Thank
Welcome
you for
the
opportunity
committee.
To come here today. You want to hit the next one? Are you doing that?
Yeah, that's you.
Right. Very quickly, the mission of the Department of Public Safety is fourfold: protect citizens and communities, to prevent, prepare, respond, recover, to educate and enforce the citizens of Minnesota, to focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, and to maintain public trust and developing and to continue to develop very strong partnerships. The transportation divisions within the Department of Public Safety are the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Traffic Safety, Administrative and Related Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety in the State Fire Marshal's Office. Mr. Chair, members, with that, I will turn the next portion of the overview over to Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. What we're going to do today is I'll walk through just an overview of the budget that was passed last year, just to remind people where we are with our budget, what the various funds are, and where the funds are used. And then I'll give a brief presentation of each division, and then ask the division director from the respective division to come up and then answer questions or address any emerging issues that may be of interest to the committee. The 2010-2011 biennial budget that was passed in the transportation area includes a total funding of $305,056,000. It was passed, the budget that was passed incorporated the governor's recommendations, and additionally it provided $250,000 for that the legislature added to the governor's recommendations for bus safety, school bus safety program in Minnesota State Patrol. So of the $305,056,000 funds, $171,936,000 or 57% is from the Trunk Highway Fund. Highway user tax distribution is $19,126,000 or 6%. Miscellaneous special revenue is $98,076,000 or 32%. And the general fund is $15,918,000 or 5%. The expenses by category, the total compensation is the largest share of the budget, comprising 73% or $220,919,000. Operating costs, which include everything from office supplies to rent to everything else other than compensation, total is $76,103,000 or 25%. We transfer funds to other agencies for other activities. That makes up 1% or $4,236,000. And then payments to individuals is at 1% of $3,798,000. Usually people have a question about what that category is, and that includes things like soft body armor, vest reimbursement for police officers in the state of Minnesota. The first division that we'll talk about is the Minnesota State Patrol. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The annual operating budget of the Minnesota State Patrol is $82,531,000, and they have a staff of 875 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. For the 2010 and 11 biennium, their budget consists of $158,578,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund, $184,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6.3 million from the General Fund. The State Patrol services include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition experts, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, the training academy, radio communications, and special response teams. And I'd ask Chief Mark Danassi to come up and talk about any emerging issues and answer any questions that you would have.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Danassi, thank you very much for presenting. Please continue. Identify yourself and continue. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Mark Danaski, Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. And if I could, Mr. Chair, just a couple of issues that I think are of note for this year, one that you may hear of during the session. During a strategic planning process that we started a number of years ago, we discussed the potential of consolidating our dispatch centers, or what we refer to as our traffic operations communication centers, or what are commonly referred to as PSAPs for law enforcement organizations. The Minnesota State Patrol operates 10 PSAPs, or TOCCs, around the state. And as part of our strategic planning process, we went through a long investigative program, and in conjunction with the Department of Public Safety, we have made the decision to reduce the number of PSAPs that we have from 10 currently now across the state to 3. And those 3 being located at our existing site here in the metropolitan area, commonly referred to as Metrocom. The Duluth site will service the northern half of the state of Minnesota, and Rochester will service the southern half of the state. This comes at a very timely moment now. As you're probably all aware, the state has invested a significant amount of money into the new ARMOR program, the 800 megahertz communication system. And as that communication comes online, fully operational in 2012, we hope then to transition into our 3 centers, which will allow us then the efficiency of just having 3 centers operating rather than the 10 that we have at the current time. A second issue that is, I think, on the forefront of a lot of people's minds, particularly up on the Capitol campus, and that is of the security of this facility and the people in it. And as you're probably aware, the Minnesota State Patrol has oversight over Capitol security. We have, for the past several months, been holding stakeholder meetings with people at the Capitol complex. We've been working with the Department of Administration and others to come up with a more comprehensive plan for security on the complex. It's a wide-ranging program. Some individuals tend to go too far one direction, talking about terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and those issues. On the other side of it, it goes on to the fact that there are people that are just fearful of walking out of this building and going to a parking lot. So it's a wide gamut of security issues that we're talking about, and we are moving forward with it. As I said, we're working with the Department of Administration and a number of entities to try and provide a more comprehensive security program for the Capitol complex. And then lastly, very briefly, and then I'll answer any questions. Whenever I go to executive staff meetings or anything, we talk about personnel, we talk about structure, we talk a lot about things, and I sometimes have to stop the motion and say, well, what are we doing about traffic safety? Because it gets all of our work seems to get caught up in other things. And as you're aware, we had a significant reduction in fatalities again in the state of Minnesota, and we're very, very happy about that. I will speak for the Minnesota State Patrol in thanking this committee and the governor and the other legislators who have supported the Minnesota State Patrol and traffic safety initiatives. It's because of those initiatives, and I will say also again because of some very good statutes that have been passed by these bodies that have allowed us to see that reduction. I'm confident at the end of the year, in particular for the Minnesota State Patrol, that you'll see a significant reduction of fatalities on our primary jurisdictional highways. The interstates and the state trunk highways of the state, I think, are going to see a significant reduction of fatalities. And once again, I think that comes directly because of the oversight of the legislature and the governor giving us the resources to do what we think we have to do. One last thing, I guess, I was talking about funding. I know that the Deputy Commissioner mentioned it. We are trying our best to hold on the costs and everything that we do with the Minnesota State Patrol, like other agencies within the department. We did not run, we typically run a recruit academy to replace positions annually. We did not do that this year, trying to keep our expenses down. We're hopeful that through salary savings, through attrition of our personnel, we can run a school next year, which would put those replacement troopers into the field in the summer of 2011. Because it is kind of a long process. But I think that's one of the questions that the legislators like to know is where are we standing in terms of our personnel. So we didn't hire anybody this year, but we're hopeful that we can do something in 2011. And with that, I would answer any questions that anyone might have.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. An issue that's been of particular interest to myself and Senator Olsen has been school bus safety. We have the Office of School Bus Safety now. Just wondering how that's all going, both the functioning of the office, but also what we're seeing in school bus safety issues. Of course, we see, you know, whenever there's an article in the paper, you know, it kind of gets supersized because each incident just seems so huge. And so we probably have a different perception of what's going on with school bus safety than reality, because whenever something happens, it's just so stark. So I'm just curious what's going on generally in that realm.
Chief Janansky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, very good question. In fact, the legislature did move forward with that appropriation, and we have filled the position administrator, along with the three troopers that are assigned to that and the other personnel. I'm looking for the numbers here. Even last year, as we brought those people online, the number of school bus inspections that we did last year has increased significantly. And in conjunction with those inspections, as you're well aware, one of the things that we talked about was not only looking at the vehicles themselves, but starting to play more of a role in dealing with the operators, the vehicle operators themselves. And so while it's too early to look at statistics as far as what any crash data or anything else that goes along with that, the unit has been stood up, and we are moving forward, and we have seen increased activity with our interactions with the not only with the buses themselves, but I think also with the bus companies and with the school districts. We have much more of an ongoing relationship with them because we have people actively involved in it.
So,
Senator Dibble.
Great. Thanks, and thank you for that. And as we learn more over time, I'd be interested, and I think the committee would probably be interested in hearing information brought back.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Colonel, are you at full force now then with the troopers or close to where your target is?
Chief Janansky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, full force goes back to the idea, and I think last year I testified, somebody asked if we were at full complement. The Minnesota State Patrol no longer has a complement or a number that's at our force. We operate within the confines of the appropriations that the State Patrol receives from this body. And so there is no magic number out there. We're operating with the funds that we have. We're doing the best that we can. And without trying to dance around it too much, we're kind of trying to save up enough money so that we can run a school next year so we can get back up some of the people that we're losing through retirements and natural attrition.
Well, Senator Olsen. Very well politically on answering some of those questions. Very diplomatic.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Well, could you give us a number of officers this year compared to 5 years ago?
Sir, I don't have, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have the numbers for 5 years ago. The legislature 2 years ago appropriated money for an additional 40 troopers. That was the last school that we ran that we added those 40. If my recollection serves me correctly, that would have brought our total number to just shy of 590 when those 40 people were actually out there. Since that time, we've had attrition, and I think we're probably down about 25 or 30 from that position right now. If I could, Major, is that about right? I think we're down about 30 from we hit that high point of 590.
Thank you.
Now, you were citing improvements in the death rate, I guess you'd say. Are those real? Is it a blip? Do you have sufficient backup to say to make a conclusion like that we're actually we've changed the numbers to the good and that it's sustainable?
And Mr. Chair, I would defer to the commissioner as well. I think if you look at or to the Office of Traffic Safety, I think if you look at the trends in Minnesota, you find the trends continuing to go down significantly, more so than I think that we thought. As a matter of fact, and I look to the director of the Office of Traffic Safety, our Towards Zero Death initiative calls for us to have a fatality rate of under 400 by next year, if I'm correct, by next year. And we're very close to that this year. And if our trends continue, I believe that we'll make that target. So, yes, and some people would say that it has to do with the economy. And I would agree that the economy has a portion of that. But I also truly believe that our agency, local law enforcement agencies, have moved more towards a directed patrol activity rather than just having random patrols. We're looking at impaired driving and finding out when and where impaired crashes are happening and directing activities there. We're looking at behavior to find out what's causing crashes and then directing specific activity, whether it's speed or seatbelt or impaired driving, intersections, and directing activities at those. And it's not only enforcement. In addition to that, we're working very closely with DOT engineers and now even engineers at the county level trying to determine if there's road modifications, something as simple as rumble strips or restriping areas that might mitigate some of these things. And then I'm also add, and I'm kind of going down the list of the three E's here, but I must also add that in Minnesota, we have probably one of the finest health response, emergency response systems in the country. And so when people are involved in crashes, the response of the emergency medical personnel to those scenes and getting those people to level one trauma centers or to the appropriate medical facilities within a very rapid, short period of time is saving far more lives. So as much as I'd love to sit here and tell you that your Minnesota State Patrol has done it all, and I think we have played a significant piece of it, I think that in large traffic safety, and I will give compliments once again to this group, I think that traffic safety has risen to a level of importance in this state where people recognize that it's something that it is part of an overall public safety issue in a community, and I think collectively between the legislature and the governor and those people that are involved, it is going down, and I think that it is marked, and I think that it is a trend that we can continue.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Chair Carlson, and thank you for that response, and I think that's great to hear. Because I think, you know, what that tells us is we're looking more at, you know, outcomes than we are at numbers and complements and staffing levels and the like. And we're probably more accustomed to police agencies telling us, well, we need X number of sworn officers out on the street and then you'll be safe. And so your response is a little more holistic and in keeping with kind of where we're going in terms of public policy and the corresponding resources and making sure that we're interacting with, you know, the engineers and stuff, making sure we're designing our roads that are safer. But at the same time, we want to be extremely aware of how our budget circumstances are affecting public safety, because that always remains number one in terms of public policy priorities. And so maybe at some point, not here, you know, how you can help us understand how you plan for your future needs and how that interacts with your staffing level, you know, your kind of projected needs for staffing. That would be really, really helpful to us, because that's something we want to be extremely in tune with as policymakers, even in a difficult budgetary environment. I do have a question. On the one side where it says there's a staff of 875 full sworn and non-sworn personnel, is that not all inclusive of the number you cited a few minutes ago? It said you're down 25 or 30 from an all-time high of 590. So does this number not include some people? Is 875 that's on the slide?
Chief Tenansky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the number that was shown on there is the total for the entire Operation Minnesota State Patrol. As I said, we have approximately, and I use the term 600, it's about 575 sworn troopers. We also have the guards that are at this facility. We have support staff. Our commercial vehicle section employs, I think, right now about 80, 85 commercial vehicle inspectors, which are non-sworn. Okay. So that civilian complement on there is inclusive of a lot of other things that's within the purview of the Minnesota State Patrol.
All right, I understand. Great.
Senator Rolstein.
Mr. Chair, Colonel, there's an issue with purchasing aviation fuel, and I can't remember exactly what the issue is, but the cost was kind of outrageous. Are you familiar with that? It was because it had to be purchased a certain way or something, and the guys were telling me that it didn't have to be purchased that way. It was – I'm not sure of the issue, but it seemed like the fuel costs for, like, the helicopters and the airplanes was just way out of line, and they said, you know, were required to purchase it this way, and they were wondering why. And so,
Mr. Chair, Senator
Tenansky,
the price of the fuel the fuel is the price of the fuel. It's whether we buy it or somebody else buys it. I believe what they were referring to is that there's a program that the federal government has. I believe it's 1199 is the government program. It's the program where public safety entities that are involved in certain aspects of Homeland Security have the opportunity to buy equipment, and in this case fuel, at a reduced rate based upon the federal government's ability to buy bulk, and then it's sold at that rate. The challenge that we have is one of, frankly, bureaucracy, where the ability to do that, and because of some liability in which the credit card holder has on that, could not be resolved at the state level between the Attorney General's office and the card holder and everything else. And so we weren't eligible based upon the fact that we could not sign a contract because the language couldn't be modified to meet state regulations. Mm. And so it isn't a number of efforts. As a matter of fact, we've been working on this for probably 5 years, and we just haven't been able to resolve it yet.
Senator Rolstein.
Well, I was just wondering if that's something that we couldn't maybe help you on, because, I mean, it's probably in the big picture, it's relatively small money, but it's still money. I'll meet with you some other day on that.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to meet with the senator and discuss that.
Thank you. Senator Kielash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I'd like a little more depth on the Capitol security. I realize we've had some incidents lately. I'm not sure if that means that you're reallocating more resources, or are we just doing a review of what the current security program is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, and I'll try to be brief. As you're probably aware, there have been a number of incidents, and as this committee is probably aware, the capital security program is funded out of general revenue. However, because the Minnesota State Patrol comes under purview of this committee, we discuss it here. But it is a separate funding entity entirely, and so it doesn't intermingle with the trunk highway funds that we have for the General State Patrol. Having said that, as you're well aware, general revenue has had some issues, and so funding for our capital complex has stayed stagnant or been down. In addition to that, there have been a number of, for those individuals who have been around for years, there it seems like about every 3 or 4 years there's a new assessment of capital security and what's right and what's wrong. In the past few years, we've had 3 independent assessments. One that we requested from the Minnesota National Guard that did a security assessment on the Capitol complex. Last year, you're probably aware that the legislative auditor did an assessment of the security on the Capitol complex. And then we just recently completed one that we requested, and we had the United States Secret Service come in and do an assessment as well. We looked at those 3 assessments and then looked at issues that were similar in all 3 of them so that we could create a series of priorities that we would like to approach to say, what does everybody looking at and saying, this is something that you need to take care of. And as we look at those priorities, once again, as I said, we're working with the Department of Administration because some of those priorities have to do with infrastructure. They have to do with bricks and mortar, how people enter and egress from parking lots, who has access, ventilation, and those types of issues. And so we've worked closely with the Department of Administration, and they've talked to the governor's office, the various legislators, about trying to move forward with some of that. On our side, we're looking at operations and trying to determine if there are some things that we can do in the short and midterm to either change our plans, to work more closely with our tenants, the people that are in the buildings that we serve, and even with these bodies. We were at a meeting yesterday, and one of the things that we talked about was how open, how receptive are legislators to conducting an exercise during session to determine what's going to happen if we have a fire or a bomb, because in some ways, many people don't know what that is. So in a lot of ways, there's a lot of little things we can shore up. And then on a more long-term process, next year we plan on coming forward with a comprehensive plan to kind of revamp the way capital security looks, incorporating a lot of things that I just talked about in a much more, for lack of a better term, comprehensive piece where what's taking place in the Capitol is congruent with what's happening with the DOT building, is the same as what's happening with the Department Administration. So we don't have 6 or 7 buildings all moving in different areas as far as security. So that's kind of the short, mid, and long-range plan of what we're trying to accomplish. Clearly, it's not going to happen this year, not in this biennium. It's something that we have to have more of a strategic look at and look downstream over several bienniums to try and take care of.
Senator Kielash.
Just could you – is there a certain immediate needs that we need to do versus – the comprehensive plan that we need to be paying attention to, or can we just assume that it's covered monetarily and down the road when we have a little more money, we can maybe implement these things? I'm just kind of looking at the seriousness of the need for the change.
Chief Dinansky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, from a short-term perspective, I do know that there's conversations going on about the infrastructure. The Department of Administration is talking about some infrastructure needs that they consider to be critical at this time. And so there's nobody from admin here, so I wouldn't, I don't want to discuss that because that's their area of expertise. But I can tell you that they are having conversations regarding that. And I know that that's happening this year.
Thank you.
Chief, I have another question about an individual issue. We passed the child restraint bill last year, and I participated in a couple of the training sessions. One of them happened to be in right out near my home, and we had 100 people come in there, grandparents, parents, and to be parents. It was really successful. And I'm wondering if you have, first of all, I guess I'd just like to have you comment on the success of the program, how well this has been received and the outreach that you've had, and then whether you've seen any kinds of results from it.
Mr. Chair, I said, from a statistical standpoint in crashes and injuries, and again, I look to the director, it's a little early in our process to look at the number of injuries that are there. Not unlike the seatbelt to some extent, there is always a little pushback. People, have some issues with it, but I think that by and large, particularly the child restraint program, That has gone over very well. And, in fact, I think the seatbelt program has gone over very well also. I know that the Minnesota State Patrol, after the inaction, we have paid close attention to the restraint law, and we have taken enforcement action on it. And I would suspect that if we were to do survey work now, that we'd find much higher compliance than there was a year ago.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving on, the next division that we will talk about is Driver and Vehicle Services. Their mission is that they are committed to providing fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. DVS has an annual budget of approximately $55.6 million, with 534 employees working in 98 locations throughout the state. Approximately $1 billion in state revenue is generated annually through DVS services. DVS is funded by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. DVS services include title and registration, auto dealer license, licensing and inspection, prorate services, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, a public information center, operations support, and e-business. And I'm going to ask Director Pat McCormick to come up. I know this is an area where people usually have lots of questions.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And as you all know, one of our key projects we're working on right now is the development of the Minnesota licensing and registration system. MNLARS is the acronym that we use, and I did provide all the committee members with our annual report. You should have that. And I just wanted to go over a few items in there and certainly then talk about a few other of our initiatives and update you on them. But on page 6, we'll start from the back. We list what we call our fast facts. And as you may remember, the mission of Driver and Vehicle Services is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely services to all our customers. And so in the top, the pie chart delineates where we've collected revenue on behalf of the state, a total of $928,400,000. And in terms of the numbers of transactions and services provided, we list that. In general, I'd say, as you know, usually we collect around $1 billion. This is a little bit under that, but if you look at vehicle titles issued, we issued 1.2 million titles this year. That is down a little bit. We usually do issue around 1.4 million, so we are down a little bit in terms of that. I'd say our registrations have stayed at their usual rate or numbers, and dealer licenses would be another area where we had some decrease this past year. Mm-hmm. In terms of driver license issued, 1.3 million, that may be a little bit lower, but we're right where we usually are. So in addition to that, I thought I would just go through looking at, first of all, probably on the page 2, where it talks about MNLAR's goals. It talks about the fact that, obviously, our goal is to provide efficient business processes and service delivery, effective integration of driver and motor vehicle information, a stable, flexible, secure web-based information system, and obviously to be able to electronically communicate with other information systems, which is certainly key to doing business at the current time within our state and across the nation. Secondly, if you look at the next page, we talk about the various stages of MNLAR's development. We have completed stage one, and in stage one, we were laying out our deliverables and goals, composing an RFP for functional requirements vendor, posting the RFP and then evaluating it. We have completed that. We have an RFP. We have a vendor that we're working with to define those requirements, and also we'll begin composing an RFP for a systems vendor. And that would, we would hope we would have that entire process completed by the end of this year. Also on page 5, we list the goals for 2010. And the first goal is to refine existing DVS as is, our current procedures, and 2B business processes. And in doing, in holding these sessions, which are going on right now, we are not only working with our staff but other key stakeholders to get their input on what their vision is for our system and how we can best deliver efficient and effective services to all of our customers and the stakeholders that we work with. We are analyzing our functional and non-functional requirements, and also that gets into more the technical side, which would talk about the architecture needed for the system, and also looking for ways we can best do our business and optimizing the business that we do in terms of finding an efficient way to deliver our services. Then issuing the RFP and hopefully procuring a vendor by the end of this year. So those would be our goals for MNLARS. In addition to that, as you all know, we have many initiatives that we've been working on. One would involve enacting or implementing legislation regarding credit card and debit card services at all of our offices, including deputy registrars and DL agents. That has been a somewhat challenging process. We're in the looking at developing rules right now, and the goal would be that all offices would offer credit card and debit services unless there was an economic hardship. There would be a rigorous procedure where an office may not have the resources, especially with the economy at this time, to offer those services. We'll be detailing that process in rules that we should be able to finalize very shortly. In addition to that, as you may remember, in working on this project, we requested that Visa offer us the ability to, and maybe use us as a pilot, the ability to allow our customers to, or allow us to charge a convenience fee to our customers, because that is how the process, that's the only way financially that we believe it's viable for us to offer those services, especially with transactions which could be costly, and we do not have the resources to be able to pick up a 3% charge for customer convenience, or 2.5 to 3%. And Visa turned us down. They do not allow any person that's offering their services to make charge the customer for that service. And so as a result, we would need to, the state would need to absorb those customer convenience fees. And as we discussed with you last year, we didn't feel that we would be able to absorb that. And I think the committee agreed that we needed to look at just providing services with the two major credit card holders that do allow you to assess the customer convenience fee to your customer, and that would be MasterCard and Discover. What we are looking at is possibly seeing if we can get ATM machines at most of our offices throughout the state, and so we're exploring that possibility. That would allow a customer who comes in thinking they can pay for their services with a credit card and they only have a Visa credit card, they would at least at that point have a credit card that they could use in an ATM machine so that they would have the cash to be able to complete the transaction, because I know many of you have had customers that have not been happy that we aren't offering credit card services at our offices, and they don't like it, especially when they assume we are offering them and they have to go home and get a checkbook or get cash. So those are some of the things we're looking at. Certainly we'll be bringing those rules forward and can describe them in much more detail once they're finalized.
Senator Bonoff has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, I'm a little bit surprised at what you're saying. I could swear that when I go into the Ridgedale Service Center and do transactions that I use my debit card that's a Visa, right? You're telling me that I never do? I always write a check?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, what I meant is that you can use your Visa card, but the retailer has to pay for the customer convenience fee that the credit card company charges the retailer for allowing them to take those services because of the credit card processing service for the credit card company. So there's a certain percentage, and most retailers just build that into whatever the price of their services is.
But Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, but the Ridgedale Service Center where I get my driver's license, they do accept it, and so they pay for it.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, yes, you're right. Hennepin County, the current DVS process is that if the deputy registrar or DL agent wants to absorb those costs, then they can allow the use of credit cards at their office. And we only have two deputy registrars that offer that. One is Hennepin County, and they do it for motor vehicle and driver's licenses. And the reason they are able to do that is they have a revenue source that they utilize to be able to pay for those costs that they absorb. Sherburne County does it just for driver's licenses, and it's a very small amount of money that they need, and they absorb those costs. So our current policy until we get this in place is that at those two offices you can use credit cards, but the deputy or the agent is absorbing those costs, and it is not coming out from the state. The state is not paying for those costs.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Well, Ms. McCormick, I think we ought to have uniform policies and procedures, number one. Number two, I think it would be a mistake to even say that we would do business with Discover and MasterCard, because the world, you know, that's not where the bulk of the business is. The bulk of the business is Visa and American Express, I would guess. And then I don't understand why we couldn't just increase, not say directly absorb, which they may prohibit us from doing, but isn't it up to us to set the fees for the driver's license? So if we don't think that we are charging enough for our driver's license, it doesn't have to necessarily be correlated to offsetting the fee. We could just decide we want to charge more for our driver's license. Couldn't we do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, certainly the state could determine that they wanted to increase the fees to be able to absorb those costs. But as I said, we're talking about a significant amount of revenue that would need to be raised in order to be able to absorb the costs. So even if only 50% of the customers used a credit card, we could be talking about, and this is without me having my folder here, so I should probably just tell you, it could be well over $10 million we're talking about. And I can get back to the committee with some numbers that we ran when we did do our credit card report that we did present to you last year.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick, but if we know it's really a 2% fee on every single thing, then I wouldn't look at it as a $10 million expenditure. I would look at it as on a $40, you know, license, we were going to increase that by, you know, 2% of the $40. And so, in essence, it really is the consumer who's paying for it, even if, you know, you state it in such a way. And I don't think that it would look like, what you're suggesting, that it's some terrible thing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I just want to explain that we're not just talking about driver's licenses. We're talking about vehicle registration taxes. We're talking about sales tax on a brand new vehicle. We're talking about expensive, very expensive purchases that happen at our office. So it wouldn't be on a driver's license, that may be true, but it was when we added all of these together. And I'd be glad to go into more detail with you and explain it if you want.
Mr. Chair, could I just add something to the issue that we've had before is that the credit card companies don't allow you to just have the person using the credit card absorb the convenience fee. You have to put that into the price of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So whether I'm paying cash or whether I'm paying a credit card, I would pay that convenience fee.
Right.
And that's been the objection of many legislators in the past, that they do not want to have people who choose to pay cash or write a check subsidize the costs for other people using the credit card. So that's sort of the trouble that we're in with this.
Mr. Chair, and then I'll let someone else take it. I'm sorry, members. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that you can run the model so that you can figure out approximately how many do end up. And you know, anyway, I would think that there's a way to figure this out, and I would suggest that we do that, but I know.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I'll get an answer either. I'm still a little confused why it is that Visa is dictating the terms to how we would run things here. And instead of the reverse, that, you know.
Mr. Chair, let me just say, Senator Dahl, we have been concerned, to say the least, about the fact that Visa dictates the rules, but that is the way currently the marketplace works. Visa is not interested in the troubles of state governments, and this is not only an issue for Minnesota, but it's an issue. They're just not willing to revise their rules to make it possible for us to be more flexible in this area.
Senator Dahl.
And just a final question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My understanding is that it's based on the purchase, whatever you go to a store or wherever, it's that they charge a convenience fee or a service charge, 2%, whatever it is, based on the amount that you bought. And how that applies to how they would know what the cash sales or anything are, I guess I'm not following that either. Why they would, if we're only going to make a transaction off my card for a $100 license upgrade or a tab fee, and the next guy comes in and pays cash, how would they know that there was a cash sale there? We're not sending them our books or anything. It's only on the transaction electronically.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the credit card, obviously the company would get copies of all those transactions, and so they do see what the transactions are for, and you have to have a contract with a credit card vendor, such as a financial institution, and so they do get those. We're having a contract with the state bank, which in our case this time around is U.S. Bank, and so those transactions are reported to that financial institution who is working with those credit card companies. So there are financial reports that go back and forth to whichever vendor it is and whichever credit card company it is. But I think it would be helpful at some point if you would like me to refresh the – I don't have the reports with me. We did pass them out last year. It might be good if I sent the report to all of you to review again, because I think it does outline what the problems are, and the committee did agree at the time with the method that we have used and did adopt the legislation, which allows us to go forward with the way we are processing or the way we are implementing credit card processing. So certainly I'd be glad to do that so that it would refresh your memory, and it might be better to see it in, in the data that we provided. That we provide some examples so you can better understand what we're talking about. It is a complicated issue.
Okay. Ms. McCormick, I'd like to rewind just a little bit back to what you said about Hennepin County and having a fund. Where does that come from again?
Mr. Chair, our previous policy, the one that we had used, was because some deputies did ask if they could charge, if they could use credit cards for transactions. And we had said the first thing we needed is to make sure that we had a secure way to, that they were meeting all the security standards in order to ensure the data was secure related to credit card use. And if they met that requirement, then if they were willing to absorb the convenience fee costs and not charge the customer, because we wanted every customer to have the same fees throughout the state, then they would be allowed to do so. Hennepin County had a program that they were using, targeting revenue that they were getting from some advertising that was being done at all of their license centers. And they received revenue for the advertising on the screens. You may have seen them if you've ever been into a Hennepin County license center. And so that was the money that they were using for that purpose. And they still are until we implement this new procedure.
So in other words, if someone comes from out of state, brings their new Mercedes-Benz in and pays the sales tax and the registration fee, they're getting a significant subsidy from that fund. Is that correct?
If they used a credit card.
Mr. Chair, if they were using a credit card, in general, you know, the offices that are doing this probably aren't doing as much dealer work, where you would have a lot of those sales tax items as you would title and tab renewal and driver's licenses. So,
that's Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of wanted to toss in a little bit about my recollection of the discussion, and it was more that this option was made for all the credit card companies to purchase or to be able to do these transactions. And if they chose not to accept the terms, fine. And I think we were talking around in this committee that if Visa is sitting there watching $10 million in fees go to MasterCard or Discover Card, they may very well change their policy of not accepting, you know, that the fees be added above. So that's how I remember it ending up. But let's see what they do after they see they're losing $10 million a year in Minnesota, and see if they don't come along with the program.
Senator, I do remember that being one thread of the discussion. I'm not sure if that was the final agreement, but I do remember we did talk about it that way.
Mr. Chair, just to remind you, there is a copy in that report of a letter that we had sent to Visa requesting that, and the letter of denial from Visa for us to serve as a pilot to try doing it, this type of transaction with a state government, the DMV of a state government. So.
Yeah. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I think we're kind of beating a dead horse here, but I think, too, as we go, this is my eighth year here, and I'm thinking this conversation is going through every year. It is time to move this ahead, but because other things in the marketplace are moving ahead as well, I can't even use a checkbook anyplace I go anymore.
Right.
And I think, and I don't remember the statistics of how many bad checks we're getting, there's got to be some offset there if we get away from checks and use convenience fees, and we should look at something like that. But, yeah, I think we should just get this project going. And if Visa doesn't want to participate, like Senator Olsen said, we kind of all had a consensus agreement there that I think the market will move Visa to want to enter it if other companies are allowing us to add that convenience fee on top. So it's just as easy to get a MasterCard as Visa, so we can play our own games with the marketplace, I guess. I want to see this move ahead, but you can't use a checkbook anyplace else anymore, I don't think, you know, except in rare occasions these days.
Senator Scoia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Senator Colk and I are over here way on the right, but tend not to lean that way.
You're not alone, Senator Scoia.
Ms. McCormick, if you could just briefly help me understand the difference between this and what the state does with your online licenses, because you can use these online. And so what's the difference between that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, that's a very good question, because the credit card companies will let you do a transaction online and pay a customer convenience fee, but they will not let you do it in a face-to-face transaction.
Thank you.
Send them to the computer. I think we got the answer right there.
Senator Moore.
So, Mr. Chair, I think that it will be cheaper if we were to put computer terminals at all our locations.
Than ATMs, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go. We're done.
That's a good
We'll get it implemented tomorrow, and we're done. We don't have to have this conversation anymore.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Bonnef.
Mr. Chair, all joking aside, imagine if you just had one computer at every one, and so those who want to use a computer, you'd say, oh, you could go log in right there. That's actually, Senator Moi, a really good idea.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I think the issue with that would be that the deputy registrars are, those offices are established so that they can have the face-to-face customer services, and you know, we do 73% of our registration renewals at deputy registrar services. So it does, Minnesotans do support their deputy registrar. So that would be the issue that I think would be a concern. I think you may hear from a few deputy registrars about that issue. So just to point that out. But.
Mr. Chair, when I got to be commissioner, four or five years, I waded in on this issue, and I thought it was a very simple issue that we could resolve. Trust me, over the last 4 years, this is an immensely more complicated issue that this body could spend literally two, three, four hours on.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different aspects to it. If it was simple, we'd have done it a long time ago. Yeah. Believe me, it isn't that simple.
Mm-hmm. I think we have spent 3 or 4 hours on it. Please continue.
Well, there's just a few other issues I wanted to update you on. As you may remember, we've been working with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration to implement the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act, and we were able to meet the requirements of electronic messaging of conviction information at the end of September, and ensure that there were no highway funds that would be lost by the state as a result. And so we are now completing that project. There are several more things that we need to do, including checking various databases regarding commercial drivers to ensure that they don't have convictions in another state, they don't have a license that's from another state, and that they are valid if they are coming into the state, so that we can ensure that we have safe drivers on the road, especially in the area of commercial driving. And so we are working on that. We are intending to issue an RFP this year for a new driver's license. And obviously, as we've had many discussions through the years, we've talked about how it's really important for us to kind of stay ahead of the curve in terms of maintaining a secure identification document, and that we have to make sure we have up-to-date security features, and certainly we will be working toward that end. Our current contract ends at the end of January of next year, and so we are beginning to gather information about new security features that we think may enhance the security of our current card. In addition, we are also involved in implementing the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System, and I know we've talked previously about this mandate from the federal government, and we are required to provide our title information into this information system so that law enforcement and motor vehicle agencies throughout the country are able to get information. It's been very helpful in preventing car thefts and also in just trying to prevent vehicle fraud. And so we're hoping that we would be able to start utilizing it by March of 2010. So in a few months, we at least are hoping that we will have begun the implementation of it. We won't be able to fully use it until we have our new information system in the way that we would like to, but we will be able to utilize it in our titling process. Other than that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
On the auto dealer licensing and inspection, I have a constituent that's always number one on his list. And he's been concerned about curbside sales throughout the state. And evidently there were some investigators that were dedicated to that sort of investigating and enforcement, and that we no longer have them, or we've cut the staff in half on that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think you're talking about an initiative that Driver and Vehicle Services collaborates with the Minnesota State Patrol on in terms of there was a vehicle crimes task force at one time. We still work very closely and collaborate with the State Patrol on these issues. Our exam staff are also vehicle inspectors. And so if we need assistance in terms of anything related to illegal practices, then we do consult with the State Patrol. And there are discussions within the department of ramping that up a little bit and trying to even add a little bit more formality to what we're doing right now. I don't know if and if Colonel Danaski, do you need to want to say anything else at this time?
Okay. Well, in his perception, the incidence of curbside sales have boomed. That there's a lot more of it going on nowadays. That and he, I think he credits part of it to the lack of enforcement, and the other is just that it's an easy way for people to make some money is to have four or five cars out in front of their house and sell them constantly.
Mr. Chair, I think speaking for State Patrol and DVS, I think we would certainly want to know if there were any, you know, if he had any particular details, we would certainly want to be following up on it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Please continue.
I think that's all I have, unless you have any other questions or issues that you want to bring up.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you, Ms. McCormick. Sorry for being so focused on that detail. It just confounded me, so thank you.
We're always glad to help. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
As Ms. McCormick's leaving, there's a gas station that I get gas at occasionally, and they have a sign up there that says there's a petition on a national level because it says that the credit card companies make more on their percentage of the gas sale than the gas station does. And so it's kind of a, they're going after a national complaint about that. So it's just kind of highlights that, you know, this is an issue in many businesses that, but they claim, you know, they make zero profit on their gas when somebody uses a credit card because the convenience fee costs more than what they're making on the gas.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just let me assure you, as Commissioner Campion said, we are very aware of how frustrating this issue is and are trying to resolve it. But moving on next to the Office of Traffic Safety, their mission is to create a culture where traffic fatalities are no longer acceptable through the integrated application of education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency trauma services. These efforts will be driven by data, best practices, and research. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000, which is a required match which allows the office to secure federal funds, grants, and one-time monies that annually amount to approximately $28 million. And when Chief Danaski was up here, we were talking about the low traffic fatality rate that we have here in the state of Minnesota, and there was a question about whether this trend was, going to likely continue or what was all went into that. And I just want to say the good partnership between the Office of Traffic Safety and the Minnesota State Patrol has really resulted in some very effective measures to reduce traffic fatalities in the state of Minnesota. And they use data very wisely, both the office and the Minnesota State Patrol, to really target resources to the most critical factors that impact traffic fatalities, and I really believe sincerely that that's why we're seeing the reductions that we've seen in the past few years, and we'll continue to see reductions. In fact, the office recently was part of a group that here in the state of Minnesota received an international award called the Global Achievement Award for their safety efforts in the Towards Zero Death program. So I think that really speaks to the progress we've made here in the state of Minnesota. The Office of Traffic Safety activities include traffic safety outreach, impaired driving prevention, occupant protection, child passenger safety, traffic records data systems, safe community coalitions, motorcycle safety, teen drivers, underage alcohol prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, crash outcome and data evaluation, fatal analysis record system, and distracted driving. And I'm going to ask Director Sheree Marty to come up and tell you about any emerging issues and answer any questions that you have.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sheree Marty. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with DPS. As already been discussed, we have seen really truly record-breaking reduction in our traffic fatalities. So we have the lowest fatality rate. We're anticipating in 2009, 400 and roughly 10 fatalities. So that's down from last year from 455. So that's an 8% decrease. And actually, since we began this very coordinated interdisciplinary approach to traffic safety in the state, that was in 2003, where State Patrol and Office of Traffic Safety, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and also the Department of Health really brought together kind of an interdisciplinary thinking to traffic safety. And when we did that, we continued to see these numbers go down. And from 2003, when the program was implemented, we've had a 36% reduction in traffic fatalities. So that is truly a success. And we're very pleased. And in 2009, although the numbers are preliminary, we are going to see the overall reduction, as I've already mentioned. We've seen a huge reduction in motorcycle fatalities, and that was trending upward, and we were very pleased to see such a strong reduction in lives saved. Also, we've seen bicyclists, that's also declining. What jumped up just a bit was pedestrian fatalities, so that continues to be a concern of ours. Many of those are alcohol-related. These are individuals that are dying too often in crosswalks. So that's just something that our office is going to continue to pay attention to. Mr. Chair, you had asked earlier if some of our new laws are making a difference. And first of all, I just want to thank you again for taking a leadership role in our booster seat bill that passed last year. We're very pleased about that. And as Colonel Donansky already said, it is a bit early to tell the impact of a few of these bills that passed so recently. But I wanted to share that we know that prior to booster, about 30% of 4 to 7-year-old children were in booster seats, only 30%. And I believe that parents and grandparents want to do the right thing. They want to keep their children safe. But we didn't have a law that enabled them to be aware of the importance of booster seats. With the passage of that, I just wanted to let you know that in a recent Minnesota Center for Survey Research at the University of Minnesota, it was part of a question about the awareness of the booster seat law. And 97% of the respondents are, in fact, aware of the booster seat law. So that is good news, that the word is out there, people are aware, and as we've mentioned earlier, we're really expecting the compliance to be very strong. I do want to also mention, of course, we made a huge step forward in the passage of the primary seatbelt bill. So that went into effect June 9th of this year. And I want to thank the committee again. That was extremely important to our agency. And we're very pleased that we believe that that bill is having the intended consequences. And I just wanted to share a few highlights. If you compare since the passage of the bill on June 9th, through November 2nd, that's 5 months period of time, we had a reduction of unbelted fatalities. If you compare that same time frame from last year, we had 16 lives were saved. These were a reduction in unbelted fatalities from that same time period last year. In addition, our seatbelt use rate went up from 87% and is now at 90.2%, and that survey was conducted in August of this year. So we know that the enforcement, coupled with the strong outreach efforts to educate people about this law and the importance of buckling up, is making a difference, because more Minnesotans are buckling up than ever before, and that's very good news. Just to mention, because I do get questions about this, the highest seatbelt use rate is with vans, minivans, followed by cars and SUVs. Our lowest rate for seatbelt use is pickup trucks. But the good news is, on the pickup trucks, we saw the greatest increase in seatbelt use with the pickup truck drivers. So that was an 8% increase from the survey done the year before.
So that's just good news for us, and I just wanted to highlight that. What we do know that is remains to be a concern is nighttime seatbelt use. 63% of our unbelted fatalities are occurring in nighttime hours. We also know that 80% of unbelted fatalities are occurring in rural communities. So that's something that is giving us, as Mary Ellison mentioned earlier, we're very data-driven. So we're looking at what does the data tell us about how we need to target our education and our enforcement efforts so that we're reaching our targeted audience and getting them to buckle up. Also, we passed a statewide pilot ignition interlock program, and we expanded our initial pilot that started in Beltrami and Hennepin counties, and currently we have 600 participants in our ignition interlock program. It's been extremely successful. We've only had one reoffense in all of those participants, so that's pretty strong. The program guidelines really are very short period of no driving privileges, either 15 to 30 days, and offenders that are canceled as inimical to public safety are required to have a limited license for 1 year plus treatment. So we are getting quite a bit of interest, about 100 new participants a month in the statewide ignition interlock program. I just wanted to maybe just briefly describe the basics of ignition interlock, and then I wanted to talk briefly about some of the pillars of the governor's proposal to help strengthen driver's license sanctions. The breath testing device is installed on an offender's starter of their vehicle, and that offender, that DWI offender, is required to blow into a tube which will detect their alcohol concentration level. So if that alcohol concentration is at 0.02 or higher, it will prevent the vehicle from starting. If it's lower than that, then the vehicle starts, but then there will be rolling retests where that driver is required at a random schedule of intervals to blow into that tube. And again, the car is continuously monitoring whether or not there's alcohol concentration in the blood. If there's a failed test while the driver is driving, the vehicle doesn't stop, but when that vehicle is stopped, it will not restart. And the main reason for that was simply because of Minnesota winters. We didn't want people being stranded with vehicles stopped. Now, after that alcohol concentration is lower and that driver blows into that tube, and if it's less than 0.02, the vehicle will start. So that's just a real high-level basic on ignition interlock. As I mentioned, the governor did announce last week his proposal to strengthen administrative penalties for impaired driving. And there's basically this proposal has three pillars. First of all, to lower the alcohol concentration threshold that triggers enhanced administrative sanctions. Secondly, to lengthen revocation periods for all DWI offenders. And three, to require the use of breath-activated ignition systems if the offender wants to drive during that revocation period. So those are the three broad pillars. And then just to speak to each of those briefly, to lower the alcohol concentration threshold that triggers enhanced administrative sanctions, what we're looking at for first-time offenders, we're looking at lowering the limit from 0.20 to 0.15, and it's at that enhancement will occur at the 0.15 level. So in other words, at 0.15, if they're higher than that, they would have a one-year revocation period. That would be enhanced. For second-time offenders, regardless of their alcohol concentration level at the time of arrest, we would apply increased sanctions to all second-time DWI offenders because it's not a matter of whether or not they're 0.15 or above, but they are now a repeat offender, and all repeat offenders at our higher risk. So just some supporting information to that point. In Minnesota, the vast majority of our drivers who are involved in fatal crashes test positively with their alcohol concentration level at 0.15 or above. So specifically, 63% of those drivers in fatal crashes are at 0.15 or above. A driver with a 0.15 alcohol concentration is 200 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than a non-drinking driver. Repeat offenders are much more likely to have an alcohol concentration of 1.5 or above.
DWI offenders with a 0.15 to 0.019 alcohol concentration level will reoffend at essentially the same rate as offenders with levels of 0.20 and higher. One half of the people arrested for DWI have an alcohol concentration level of 0.15 or greater. And then finally, 40 states that have established alcohol concentration levels that trigger enhanced administrative sanctions. Half of those states, which there are 40, actually use the 0.15 to trigger enhanced administrative sanctions. So Minnesota is actually one of five remaining states that trigger administrative sanctions or enhanced sanctions at 0.20. So the second pillar of the governor's proposal is to lengthen revocation periods for all impaired driving incidences. So just to give you a quick snapshot, first-time offenders, their revocation currently is 6 months. That would be expanded or strengthened to 12 months, depending on their alcohol concentration level. The second-time offender goes from 6 months to 2 years. Third time, 1 year to 3 years. The fourth-time offender would be, currently it's 3 years, it would be strengthened to 4 years, and the fifth-time offender would be for 6 years, revocation period. The third pillar of the proposal is to require the use of breath-activated ignition systems if the offender wants to continue to drive during their revocation period. So just to briefly, a few supporting points. Ignition interlocks are effective in reducing reoffense of DWI up to 90%. It also provides a means for DWI offenders to be legal drivers and maintain safety on our roadways. So just a supporting point, we have truly an epidemic of illegal driving on our roadways. Currently, we have 40,000 convictions each year of illegal driving and many more arrests. The lengthened revocation periods will encourage the use of ignition interlock. And then finally, time periods are designed to encourage ignition interlock use during a time of high risk for reoffense. And this high risk for reoffense is also a high risk for being involved in an alcohol-related fatality or serious injury crash. So we know that longer time periods are more likely to change driver behavior. One of the things that we're learning in our pilot program is these offenders who drank the night before, they get in their vehicles the following morning thinking that their alcohol concentration level should be fine. But in fact, it's not, and it's still far too high. And they never would have realized that had they not been on the ignition interlock system. So it's raising their awareness, and it's helping to modify their behavior. And that's part of the strength of this proposal. Finally, I just want to comment on why it's important to focus on first and second time offenders with the ignition interlock system. Of all drinking drivers involved in a fatal crash, 40% had a previous DWI on their record. If you look up that 40% of that group, about half of them had one DWI on their record, and about 30% had two DWIs on their record. So if you just focus on the first and second time offenders, you're addressing about 3/4 of the repeat offenders. So we believe that focusing on the first and second offenders will have the greatest impact on reducing alcohol-related fatalities and serious injuries on our roadways. So that's just kind of we were asked to give a brief overview, which I've done, and I would welcome any questions.
I believe you said that the threshold is 0.02 before the vehicle will not start?
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is that set in rules, or did we have that in the statute?
It is in rules. Okay. It's part of the performance standards, and it is written in rule.
Okay. Because this is a pilot program, is there any other limits or thresholds that you're attempting to try out or test?
The 0.02, I will say, that is a level that's recommended by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and most states have it set at 0.02, so I'm not aware of any other level that's been tested.
No. There's Florida. Excuse me.
Please come up to the microphone. identify yourself for the record, too.
Hi, I'm Jean Ryan from the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety, and I've been working on the Ignition Airlock Program. Florida is the only other state that has a set limit of 0.05, and most states have a 0.02 set rate for not allowing the vehicle to start.
Okay, thank you. And another question is this... is this used as a stay of sentence, or it, you, can you take this as an option for a stay of conviction? So
what
you, or do you need to be convicted to get this this opportunity to drive with interlock?
This is purely on the administrative side, on the civil side. So, you know, this would be in effect regardless of the decision that the courts might make. So this is an immediate option for an individual who normally would have their license revoked. So this is an administrative sanction. But we're giving them the opportunity to drive immediately with the ignition interlock system. Well, not quite immediately, after a short period of revocation. Mm-hmm. So it's either 15 or 30 days.
So there'd be a conviction and then a revocation, and then you'd have this opportunity. Correct.
I'm not sure that you would necessarily be convicted. I think this is something that really is separate from that. So really, it's a separate track. It's the civil track. So I don't think that it has an impact. It would be impacted whether or not it's convicted.
Okay. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for, is it Ms. Marty?
Yes,
thank you. Thanks for that presentation. I have been following what was going on with the ignition interlock and think it's a wonderful program. And some of us legislators had the opportunity this summer to go to the Hennepin County Courts and what they're doing with their pilot with the drug and alcohol courts. And I watched the judges interact with some of the citizens who were, you know, going through their track and being mm-hmm. a part of the ignition interlock, and they were having amazing success. And it was very inspiring. I think you were there, Senator Olson. It was inspiring to see the way the judges were able to work with these offenders because they were in this program and how good that was going.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for those comments. And we would agree that highly intensive supervision program through the DWI course, it's very effective.
Senator Olson.
One of my concerns is around this table, we've had a lot of discussion about, you know, people will buy a car with the tabs, you know, 11 months left on the tabs and just drive and not, you know, re-register the car. Do you think that having the interlock system as an option, will more people will follow the law and opt to do that? Or, you know, there's always that certain percentage of people that just kind of ignore the law, buy a car and drive, no license, nothing, and no insurance or anything. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we do feel that by giving them the opportunity to drive legally and giving them full driving privileges is an opportunity that currently, with longer revocation periods and not having that option, more people will choose to drive illegally. But what we're finding is in the pilot program, it's been very successful because we are giving them that option earlier than later to be legal and to have full driving privileges. So we do feel that this is part of the answer in reducing the number of illegal drivers on our roadways.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Murphy brought up last year when we were discussing this, is there technology to be sure that it's you blowing into the interlock or your friend sitting next to you?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Senator, there is a pattern in blowing into the device that requires some learning and some practice and some training. So it's not quite as easy for someone who's not familiar with the device to step in and blow in it for that driver. This isn't a foolproof system, but because of the protections built into the technology and the training and the learning involved, so that would require some humming, a quick intake while you're blowing. It's a pattern, it's a sequence that needs to be learned, and that helps to safeguard against someone else stepping in and blowing into that. In addition, there are rolling retakes that's required while driving. So that also helps to safeguard against that.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Marty. A couple of quick questions. One on the technology, the system. Is it also once they if they weren't able to start the car because they were in violation, is there a signal or data that goes to some central database that says, you know, there's a violation has occurred? That does happen? Okay.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the data, the information is stored within the vehicle, and then the vehicle has to be brought to the vendor once a month for a data download. Okay. That information is downloaded to the vendor. That information from the vendor is then transferred to driver and vehicle services, who will have staff there monitoring and looking at that download reports and seeing is that person having the fails, what's the pattern of use with that vehicle, are they trying to use another vehicle. They're looking at a number of factors to see what the driving behavior and if they've been driving and not drinking.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is on some of the statistics on where we're seeing these crashes out in more of the rural counties, mm-hmm. and at night and things like
right.
that. Some of the things that, if you could tell us some of the things you are doing, are you putting signs up, maybe on billboard signs, to remind people, put your seatbelts on and do things? Is there an education program of some sort to kind of alert people that this is a high fatality area, or I don't know. What's the program that you might be doing?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we have a number of strategies that we try to educate the public. It was mentioned earlier by Colonel Donansky that we are now working very closely with each of the counties in developing county highway safety plans. And those individual plans for all 87 counties, and this will roll out in the next 3 years, but the communities are getting involved. They're looking at our crash data. They're knowing for their local community, why are people dying? Where are they dying? Are they belted? Are they not? They're looking at their crash information and then working with our office in identifying effective strategies to get people to make the right choices behind the wheel. So our office is very engaged in local communities through grants and through this new program to roll out safety plans in each of the counties. In addition, we have a very strong communications and outreach program. We have paid media that's going out throughout the state. So we're working with radio stations. We're buying, you know, TV time. We have online communication. We also have, so it's in print, it's on the web. We've got radio, television, and it really is a statewide network to get the information out. So between the work that we're doing centrally to get the information out, working with our local communities, working with our local grantees, we feel very strongly that the information is getting out there. People know that they should wear their seatbelt. People know that they shouldn't drive impaired. So I will tell you that as much as communication is important, if it's not coupled with effective enforcement, it's really not going to change driver behavior, because what's most motivating to drivers is consequences. So we want to make sure that we educate them about an enforcement effort, we tell them about the enforcement effort, and then we tell them how effective it was afterwards. And our communication is really structured around those three things.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Alcine.
Mr. Chair. I feel privileged to have Judge Dean in my district and his work on the Safe and Sober Cab programs. Do you have any ideas or plans to move that forward throughout the state?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Senator Alcine, yes, we do have plans. We have been talking with Judge Dean, and he has a very effective Sober Cab program. And one of the steps that we have taken is developing an implementation guide for other counties who want to implement a similar program. And that guide, a draft, has just been completed, and we are working with the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies in its final finishing form over the next few weeks. And we are planning on distributing that statewide. So any county that wants to implement a similar safe and sober program would be able to look at Judge Dean's model in Isanti County, but also other models that have been effective in reducing impaired driving on the roadways and really giving people the options to driving impaired. So this guide will be available. After that, we are looking at how the Office of Traffic Safety can fund support so that other counties who are interested could get technical assistance. So we are looking at that, and we're discussing what that would look like. And I believe that part of the partnership will be for we'll be working with the Center for Excellence in Rural Safety at the University of Minnesota, partnering with them with the Department of Public Safety and how we can make that technical assistance available statewide.
Ms. Marty, could you give us a little rundown of where you're at with gathering information on distracted driving, and especially with the handheld phones and hands-free phones? And I know Secretary LaHood was here Monday, I believe it was, and he didn't let me down. Just about every time he has a speech, he mentions that at the end of his speech that we need to pass legislation to ban handheld phones and texting while driving. And there was a discussion of some of us last week about hands-free versus handheld, and the opinion was that hands-free is not a great solution either. And I'm wondering if you have any information on that also.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members, distracted driving truly does plague our roadways, and it's definitely a primary concern in traffic safety. What's challenging about distracted driving is really having good data to tell us what is truly happening behind the wheel in people's cars. The data is not there the way we'd like it to be, simply because people who are in a crash, they're not going to admit that they were on their phone, they were texting, they were reaching for a hamburger, whatever they were doing behind the wheel, because there are so many forms of distraction, and we don't want to say that it's just limited to cell phones and texting. But we do know that texting is in its own category of risk. That is a major concern, and we're very pleased that we did pass a no texting, no emailing, no accessing web. So it's important that we don't just describe it as no texting. Bill, August 1st of 2008, and Minnesota truly was one of the leading states in passing that legislation. And I think the strength of that legislation is really giving parents a tool to communicate to their younger drivers, this is risky, it's against the law. So it helps to give them more leverage to prevent their younger driver from doing this. But just want to emphasize, it's not only younger drivers, because we've got many adults are checking their emails, accessing the web. So it is a concern. I think that one of the things that we clearly want to be sure that we're doing is that we're educating the public on the risks of distracted driving. The fact that if you're on your phone, you're 4 times more likely to be in a fatal crash and so forth. And with texting, it's by far more riskier. So I think education is part of the answer. We are also looking at having a distracted driving day. The governor each year proclaims August 1st as distraction-free driving day. So coupled with that day, we will be adding added enforcement, and then we will be giving a lot of communication about the added enforcement. This is a new initiative by the Office of Traffic Safety. Just, again, the purpose is to build awareness, public awareness, have that media support around this particular day. But obviously, this is a message that we do carry throughout the entire year. So this is something that we get a lot of media attention on, and we are speaking to this pretty aggressively. Also, we're looking at modifying our police accident report, which then feeds into our crash records, of separating out texting from cell phone use. So when an officer who arrives at a crash scene and they indicate the factors contributing to that crash, they'd be able to single out texting versus cell phone and so forth. To your point, Mr. Chair, about is hands-free any safer? Frankly, I don't think that hands-free is safer. It isn't so much where your hands are, but where your mind is, and thinking about driving and the task of driving. Driving itself is a multitasking activity. To be engaged in a conversation with someone who's not sitting next to you, who doesn't know what you're facing as you're driving, if you're coming up too close to another driver, if you're starting to slide, that individual talking to you on the phone has no awareness of what you're doing as a driver, and they can't really respond like someone sitting in the vehicle with you. So just to say that I feel that there isn't quite the data to support that it's that much safer to have a hands-free device versus it's cell phone use and it's the conversation that's causing the problem.
I've heard of, when we were discussing it, we talked about an interesting story where one of the people that was in the conversation ran, you know, gave us the anecdote about an accident where a person had involved in the accident got out of the car and was still talking on the phone. And that's how engaged they are in the phone conversation, that they don't drop the phone, they don't stop talking. And that same day, up here in John Ireland, right by the cathedral, a fender bender, and the woman got out of the car, and she was still talking on her phone. So I know that that actually does happen.
Yeah.
And there's a, and I think we've had an exemption in that that statute where it exempts using navigators.
That's correct.
And in my case, my phone also has my navigator on it, and my navigator is also a web-based navigator. So how are we looking at that, where we exempt navigators, but it is web-based?
Mr. Chair and members, the GPS units right now in your vehicles, you know, those are exempted. So that is allowable, that mobile data allowed through that device. The concern is the distraction, and I do think that there's a lot of information coming into a vehicle. And so if you are going to be taking your eyes and looking at a device rather than looking at the road ahead of you, that is increasing the risk. And I do have concerns about that. I think that these devices have safety features built into them. So I do know the GPS units that are in vehicles, they have a safe mode. So if you're driving, there's certain features that are disabled. I don't know if that would be true using the cell phone and the cell device. So that raises a concern for me. Mm-hmm. So I do have concerns about so much information coming into a driver while driving. And just to emphasize that the reason for the concern on distraction is you need to be driving for the unexpected. And if everything goes as planned in front of you, you probably are okay. Unfortunately, so much unexpected does happen, and when you're distracted, you're not able to respond quickly in a timely manner to keep yourself and others out of harm's way.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Do we have more?
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two, Mr. Chair, we have two other divisions to cover during our presentation. The next one is administration and related services, and that includes the Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technical and Support Services. Certainly this is the most exciting and snappy area of the agency. Finally, we have the Office of Pipeline Safety. And their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. The Office of Pipeline Safety, their budget includes $2.25 million per year in special revenue and federal funds, and $1.35 million per year is a direct appropriation, again, a special revenue derived from inspection fees and excavation damage prevention penalties. And I'll ask State Fire Marshal Jerry Rosendahl to come forward and talk about any emerging issues and answer questions.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Jerry Rosendahl, the State Fire Marshal and the Director of Pipeline Safety. And there is a handout, I believe, that was provided to you with just a one-page type of fact sheet. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, obviously. I'll just try to highlight a couple things. We do have a kind of a theme song in Pipeline Safety, and that's called Keep It in the Pipe. But Commissioner Campion asked me not to sing it, so I'll move on. The Office of Pipeline Safety was created in 1987 after the Mounds View pipeline release ignited and was a fatal situation. Our office inspects both interstate as well as intrastate pipelines. And the interstate we do under the authority of the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration. We have updated our numbers in terms of the miles of pipeline in Minnesota. The commissioner is fond of using that as a trivia question. And it used to be 65, 66,000 miles. But over the last couple of years and now going forward into this next year, we are now saying 70,000 miles of pipeline in Minnesota. And I just comment a little factoid on that. Less than 20% of the materials that flow through those pipelines are used in Minnesota. In other words, we are kind of a gateway from Canada, from other states, to other states, and down into the Chicago area. The materials of energy flow through us to other areas. The pipeline projects that I talked about that kind of built up the mileage, several major projects that started in 2009 and are scheduled to be complete in 2010. The Enbridge-Alberta Clipper Pipeline will ultimately transport up to 800,000 barrels of oil per day to the Midwest market, and that amounts to about 20% of the current oil demand for the entire Midwest. So that all is flowing through our area. Our office does investigations of pipeline incidents, and you would recall in 2007, the very end of the year, the Enbridge accident, which did cause two fatalities. The results of that, since that was an interstate line, the federal office administers the penalties, but that was a $2.4 million penalty that was assessed to Enbridge. The appeals and that whole process are still working their way through. And then just recently, in 2009, the Koch pipeline, an oil leak, and that wound up with 5,000 barrels of crude oil that were spilled with a lot of cleanup. I highlight the fact that in both those cases, there were errors made during a time of repair. So it's not just an ongoing, something happened out of the blue. It was errors that were made, and so penalties are involved, and we are involved in issuing penalties. On the back side of that fact sheet, I'll just highlight the damage prevention piece, or in other words, the prevention, the education piece. We enforce known as the one-call law, or the Gopher State one-call system, and we do issue penalties out of that. And I would just highlight that the education area is what we do first and foremost and overall, as opposed to enforcing or issuing penalties. Statistics, Senator earlier talked about outcomes, and certainly we're all about that. Our statistics collected in damage prevention enforcement realize that the enforcement and education program has contributed to reducing damages to gas and electric facilities by nearly 70% since 1996. So we do collect the data. We do believe the education combined with the enforcement, which you've heard from other division directors, the combination is what works for us, and that's what we work toward. And you see our contact information and staffing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Any questions from the committee? Now, refresh me, the Koch release, what was that again and where was that?
But I have with me a chief engineer for pipeline safety, Elizabeth Skalnick, who is up on that site. And as I was going there, I was going to say where it was, and I honestly just forgot, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Skalnick, and I'm the chief engineer for the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. I did go to that site. It was in Staples, Minnesota, or a little bit just outside of Staples, Minnesota. It was the leak occurred during a repair procedure, and may I go into the little more detail?
Yes, please.
I was telling Jerry, I said, you know, I think you should talk instead of me because I get so excited about this and I hate to bore people with great detail. But, this was made during a repair procedure. And the world of pipeline safety has really changed dramatically in the past 10 years. It used to be that we didn't really know a lot about the pipelines that were buried beneath our feet, but the regulations have changed and required pipeline operators to run these inspection tools and to make repairs, and that program has really ratcheted up the amount of repair activity that's happening with these pipelines. And in fact, Koch was implementing this program and making some repairs when this leak happened. It was unfortunate. It was, I call it the they don't do it like they used to kind of thing, because some less experienced folks didn't do the procedure right. It led to a leak.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a proposal for this Excelsior Energy plant. It would be built, and they would be piping carbon to Canada to have it sequestered underground. Would that fall under your jurisdiction?
Yes, our office regulates all natural gas and hazardous liquid pipelines. We would call that a hazardous liquid pipeline. Carbon dioxide is really one of the most up-and-coming new technologies that we need to prepare for, because what's inside the pipe affects how we regulate it and the technologies that are needed to keep it safe. So, yes, that would be us.
And a follow-up.
Senator Olsen.
My world involves a lot of steel and those kinds of things, and I'm curious on these pipelines, when you're running a tool through there to measure, are you measuring like the thickness of the wall, and what is the average life of a pipeline?
Ms. Gelding.
Thank you, Chairman and Senator. The average life of a pipeline is forever.
Really? It doesn't break down? And
I'm not saying that it doesn't break down, but there's a huge amount of complexity in right-of-way issues, and trying to get a new right-of-way for a pipeline is very, very difficult. So we're almost in a situation where we want to run these pipelines forever, if we can. And so the protection technologies have dramatically improved. We're looking at that a lot more closely, because there are certain pipelines that, when they sort of haven't been protected, if they were, say, installed long ago before we had these rules, they have to be replaced. But we're building pipelines today that I cannot really say that there's ever going to be a time we won't need them. So we need to build them. It's very different. I used to be in the tank and pipe industry, and we'd build a tank, as you might know, for 20 years. We'd say it's going to last 20 years. We're going to decommission it. We'll build it new. But in a situation where you have a plant that's under your control, you can do that. You can knock the walls down. You can put new walls up. When you have to go and dig up everybody's property for 400 miles to replace a pipeline, that gets very complicated.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator, if I could,
just to the point about
testing that goes on, there are just a multitude of different tests and ongoing maintenance checks that they do, and they can measure the thickness, and they can see if there's something going on here, if there's a hit, and now we've got some corrosion building up. And through our inspectors who check those records, it's certainly a concerted effort to make them last forever, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Senator Kielesch.
I'm just wondering, what kind of fees are we getting for the pipelines that are running through the state, especially those that are just pass-throughs, and is it paying for the department or?
Mr. Chair?
Rosenthal.
And Senator, our funding, as I think was on one slide, essentially the entire office is paid for a combination of federal funding for doing the inspections on the interstate lines. The remainder is made up of either penalties off our Gopher State One Call fines, or it's billed back to the operators. So the operators that we are inspecting and are causing issues, all of our costs are paid through that means.
Thank you.
I had a question. I can't forget. Any other questions from the committee? I had another question, and I can't. I lost it after Ken asked his, but. I guess it wasn't important. Thank you.
We're available by phone or email, sir.
Okay. Oh, I know. Now I know. Yeah. It was about the age again. In your opinion, are we headed towards any kind of, are we pushing any kind of a wave in front of us in the deteriorating infrastructure? Is there something that gives you concern about the responsibilities you have? Leading towards, are we pushing ahead a possible disaster?
So
a minor disaster, anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. I think the opposite is true. I think that we are, on a daily basis, averting potential disaster. When I said the pipeline will last forever, I didn't mean in its current form. It might have some patches. It might have some areas where perhaps the coating has failed and we've had to fix the coating. It may be cut out in some small areas. What I'm sure you know about steel is if steel is protected from corrosion, mechanical damage, fatigue, whatever the other threats are, it can last forever. There's nothing inherent about steel that makes it just deteriorate that I'm aware of. Maybe someone else does. Unless there's some sort of flaw. So there's no good reason why what we have in the ground is inherently compromised. And we have the technology now to even discover if the steel's too hard in some spots. You asked if we can directly measure the thickness. There are tools that directly measure just the thickness, but there are other tools that measure many other properties. If there's a potential for maybe a hard spot that could potentially fatigue or a crack, or even we do these magnetic tests where we check the magnetic field for any sort of deformity there might be. So the technology is, and then there was another thing I was speaking to Jerry about before this, the technology in the pipeline industry is evolving incredibly rapidly in response to these new regulations. And so what my answer to you today about what we can see in a pipe is going to be probably different next year.
And on the new pipeline that's going to the west of the Twin Cities and coming in from the bottom, is that a two-way pipeline? And does that particular pipeline give you any or require any different approach to maintaining it or the oversight?
Mr. Chairman, there are two separate pipelines. One of them goes one way. The other goes the other way. One of them is bringing the tar sands oil down from the Alberta tar sands. The other is coming from our refineries and other refineries, and it's sending the diluent that allows that tar sand oil to be pumped. So the tar sand when they mine that, it's almost like a chipping procedure. It's like chunks of asphalt, and then they mix it with the sort of like a mineral spirits gasoline type product, and then that dissolves it, and then they can pump it to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Senator Jungbauer.
I just want to compliment our testifier here, having dealt with many departments around the state of Minnesota that have no clue on technology and many times have no clue what they're talking about, I'm impressed to hear your testimony. Thank you.
Very much so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, the Department of Public Safety is an immensely complicated and diverse department. You just get a little taste of it today.
Well, and I do appreciate your jobs and the testimony you guys do provide to us because it's very accurate and detailed. Thanks.
It's always good to have an engineer up there.
Thank you. You're very kind, and not many people share that opinion.
Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation for this afternoon, unless anybody has any further questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. And the meeting is adjourned.